Hello and welcome to Screening Room with Chet and Dee. I'm Chet.
And I'm Dee.
I'm a boomer.
And I'm a millennial. And we both love classic movies.
And we think you're going to love them too if you give them a shot.
Which is where we come in.
We're here to talk about those old movies. We'll tell you why we think they're so good, and we'll give you a little background about how they were made.
And we'll also tell you, talk about those movies, what they can teach us about history, about people.
And maybe even about the meaning of life. Good movies try to do that.
And that's why we want you to watch them. And apparently we've been so out of practice from this that we didn't do the intro boilerplate as well as we usually do.
No, it's we got a little rusty.
It's been too long. Welcome to 2021, people.
Yeah, it's been
Screeners.
Quite a while. Yeah,
We survived. The country has survived so far.
Yes.
We're still
no
here.
Last man on earth.
That's right. Yeah, we were worried about should we do apocalyptic shows just to get people prepared, and it didn't happen. It didn't happen. We're all still here. So thank goodness for that.
And what are we here for today?
Oh, we're here to talk about you.
Is this like a Valentine's Day movie?
Well,
last year we did The Way We Were.
It kind of is. It's a.
It's February.
It's got romance. There's no question that there is romance, both on screen and off. In this movie.
I wonder what movie you could be talking about.
Yeah, well, you talk about classics. We discuss classic movies, but this is a classics classic movie with one of the biggest stars ever in Hollywood, Humphrey Bogart, and his love interest, Lauren Bacall. The first of three movies. This is the film debut for Lauren Bacall.
Four
movies that they did together, and it's the film debut for Lauren Bacall. It's 1944, To Have and Have Not.
And she had a late in life coming up in Hollywood, right?
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all. Tell us about Lauren Bacall. Just a little primer. We'll get into more of it later, but tell us a little bit about Lauren Bacall.
Okay, well, everybody that talks about Lauren Bacall talks about how she was a model and she was discovered, and so then you're like, oh, so she was the shallow person that somebody just sees how gorgeous she is, and she automatically just falls into figuring out how to become an actor, even though she'd never really wanted to become a star and anything other than being a model to use her looks to be paid.
Not at all. No.
Okay, so she grows up in New York. She goes to boarding school when she's little. She grows up in a middle-class lifestyle. And her uncle pays for her way to go to middle school.
Mm-hmm. Because his father's gone.
Go to boarding school. Her father's gone. They just want her to have a more stable. Her mom's working all the time.
Uh-huh.
And she discovers her love for theater. She does some acting at this boarding school.
Yeah.
She graduates at age 11. She goes to high school in New York. And she's on the weekend. She does the New York School of Theater. So they do some improv. They're memorizing some lines.
You seem to know a lot about
She does
Lauren
some dancing.
Bacall.
I did read most of her autobiography so far.
I see.
And it's called By Myself and Then Some.
Mm-hmm.
And, okay. So she actually had a love for it. She wanted to grow up to be a star on the stage, much like Barbara. She wanted to have her name in lights.
Barbara.
Oh, yeah, sorry. We're on a first name basis. Barbara Streisand.
Oh, her again.
Yes, her again. But both.
They did a movie together, didn't they?
They did. The Mirror Has Two Faces.
Okay.
1997.
Okay.
So anyway.
She had something else in common with Barbara, didn't she?
Yeah, and she's a blonde and green-eyed, but she's Jewish.
She's Jewish. A nice Jewish girl. I didn't know that about Lauren Bacall.
Yeah, you just learned that a couple days ago, didn't you?
Yeah.
As I did.
And I guess a lot of people in Hollywood didn't know either when she first started out.
And I think it's amazing that even though she's 19, she figures out that she kind of needs to hide that.
Yeah.
She already knows what anti-Semitism is. She knows that if somebody's joking about somebody Jewish, they feel comfortable around her to do it because they don't think she's Jewish.
And a specific person who made anti-Semitic jokes around her
The director of this movie, Howard Hawks.
Howard Hawks. Yeah.
Who or whom? We've talked about. Because I figured it was whom.
Mm-hmm.
Whom we've talked about from The Thing from Another World. Excuse me.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Howard Hawks. This is... Okay.
Yeah, The Thing from Another World. A sci-fi. And then he's
Yeah, and we talked about Howard Hawks.
This is before The Thing from Another World, but...
Yeah, quite a bit at the time. But it's worth repeating. This is one of... we said before, this is a classics classic. Everybody who loves old movies loves this movie. And it's, yeah, it's great because of Bogart and Bacall, but it's also great because of Howard Hawks. And we're talking about one of the greatest directors of all time.
Okay, but then also how he comes to actually do this movie. It's a movie based on an Ernest Hemingway book, To Have and Have Not, mm-hmm. but yet it sounds like the movie isn't at all like
not
the
all
book.
That close. Like, I haven't read it.
Yeah, but okay, so he's on a boat with Ernest Hemingway, and he's like, yeah, I can take any of your books that are really bad, and I can make it into a movie.
Yeah. Not that Ernest Hemingway wrote a lot of bad books, but Howard Hawks specifically said, this is the worst book he ever wrote, but I can make a good movie out of it. Yeah.
Yeah. So he's brutally honest.
Mm-hmm. Oh, just let's tick off a few other Howard Hawks classics, just so we get an idea of who this guy is. Bringing Up Baby, like my favorite screwball comedy of all time, 1936. That's Howard Hawks. And then His Girl Friday, another really great comedy from that same era. Sergeant York.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so back to the other movies. Bacall, she grew up loving to watch movies. She would kind of skip school to go watch the movies. Uh-huh. Like, when it's raining, she wanted to be watching the movies. So she saw His Girl Friday, and she wanted to be a journalist for a little while. So she actually really, really, like, he accomplished what he wanted to accomplish with wanting to have women be independent.
Yeah.
Their own person and ambitious. Yeah. He actually really did, before he started molding her, which she talks about, mm-hmm. he actually did it through the screen. He reached through it, and she really liked when she was thinking about signing. So after she does get discovered by being a model, but we'll go back to how she gets to that point. But a bunch of, so Howard Hawks and some Columbia Studios reached out to her after they saw her picture to sign her, and she was thinking about what kind of, she's like, do I want to be a face of a bunch of other pretty girls, or do I want to be with Howard Hawks? And she was thinking about Bringing Up Baby and His Girl Friday. And
yeah, so she goes with
Sounds
Howard
like
Hawks.
She was already having some good decisions even at 19. She did was advised by her uncle, but...
Yeah, but she's a smart lady. Yes. Yeah, and again, Howard Hawks loves strong, independent women, and we talked about this in The Thing from Another World about how there's really only a couple of women in that film, but part of what makes the film so good is that the women are these strong carriers who don't put up a lot with a lot of crap from the men, and they actually have a very adult kind of romance going on in that film, and we're going to see that sort of thing here too. But let me keep ticking off some other Howard Hawks. We've got The Big Sleep. Again, another Bogart and Bacall film, 1946. And then one of the greatest westerns of all time, Red River. We already mentioned The Thing from Another World, where technically he's not credited as a director, but we kind of think he did. Monkey Business, another great comedy. He loved working with Cary Grant, by the way, and who wouldn't, of course. Another great western, Rio Bravo.
I would say maybe the other men in the movies would maybe not like working with him.
Well, that might be true.
More for superficial reasons.
Yeah, that's true.
Nothing on the character of the guy. I'm sure he was wonderful.
Yeah. And then still, in the 60s even, I love, there's a movie called Man's Favorite Sport with Rock Hudson, and it's one of the better performances you get from Rock Hudson, who wasn't capable of a whole lot, but Howard Hawks, he does comedies, he does westerns, he does action movies, he does sci-fi, he does it all. And it's one of the reasons that, I mean, yes, you got two great stars and some great supporting actors in this film, and that's a huge part of the success, but Howard Hawks and the script, he's got Ernest Hemingway giving him the story and doing a little bit of collaboration. He's got William Faulkner working on the script, so he's got two Pulitzer winners working on the script, and then he's got, who's the other guy? Jules Furtham, who was the main writer in The Big Sleep, and then a couple other guys working it. And the script is just, it's so tight. The movie just clicks along. There's not a bad scene in the whole film, and you're just going to love it. It's one of these movies. I watched it a couple of nights ago. If it was on tonight, I would sit down and watch it again. If it was on the next night, I just, you start watching it and you just can't look away. It's just so good. It's so fun. There's a little bit of, you know, drama, some suspense in there, but mostly it's just, I love these characters. You love the setting. It's kind of exotic. It's set in the island of Martinique, and it just sweeps you along, and you're going to love this film. If you haven't seen it, you're going to love it, and we're going to tell you more why you're going to love it.
Are you going to love it?
I think I already told you why you're going to love it, but let's talk about some of, maybe we should get to what happens in the movie. Maybe we should cover the plot. Do you think?
Go ahead.
Talk about the plot?
Go ahead. Yep.
Okay. All right. We said it's set in the island of Martinique. So it's in the Caribbean, but this was a French colony. But this is it's set in 1940. They filmed it in 1944, but they go back in time to 1940, and France has just fallen. So Vichy is running the island now. So it's the French government that's cooperating with the Germans that's in charge, and then you get a whole bunch of French resistance people on this island who are resisting, as resistance people do. And you've got Harry Morgan, Humphrey Bogart's character, who runs this charter fishing business, and he's got this boat, he's got this client, this American client, and the resistance guys come to Harry Morgan and they say, hey, we want to get these resistance leaders onto the island, and we need somebody who's got a boat to do it, and we'll pay you to do it. And Bogart says, no, I don't want to get involved in that kind of thing. But then his American client owes him a whole bunch of money. He's been taking him out for like 2 or 3 weeks, and then right before he signs over the traveler's checks, these resistance guys get into a shootout with the authorities, and they shoot up the bar where they're at, and the client croaks, and he doesn't have time to sign the traveler's checks, and all of a sudden, Harry's out of money. So he's desperate, and he says, and he's a little, you know, ticked off at the authorities because of what they've done, and he says, okay, I'll go get your resistance guys. Meanwhile, he meets Marie.
I was going to say, you are making it the bogey movie.
Okay, all right. He meets, who's Marie? Tell us about Marie.
No. No, you tell us about Marie, since you were leaving her out a lot of it.
Well, okay, Marie is just this young, beautiful American girl. We know very little bit about her past. All we know is that she's kind of stranded there, and she meets Bogart, and you talk about on-screen chemistry.
Oof.
You talk about it. Whoa.
No, you're getting steamy. You have to get a fan to...
Yeah. I mean, if you've ever heard, you know, the dialogue where he's, you know, what does she say? What does she say to him?
Which line?
She's
got a couple. You don't have to say anything. You don't have to do anything. Not a thing. Or maybe just whistle. You know how to whistle, don't you, Steve? Put your lips together and blow.
Yeah, that's the line. Okay, yeah, everybody knows that line. If you've heard that line before, this is where it comes from, okay? So they've got that romance started. Okay, so then he says, all right, I'll go out and I'll get your resistance guys. You know, you pay me your money, I'll get the resistance guys. And he goes, and the resistant guys turn out to be a man and a wife, and a very lovely woman is the wife.
Lovely is a stretch.
No, it's not a stretch. It's not a stretch. The woman who plays, what's her name? Dolores Morant, she's a beauty queen, literally a beauty queen.
I didn't say her looks weren't lovely.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So anyway, he picks them up, and they're in the boat, and then they meet a patrol boat, and they get into a shootout, and of course the stupid resistance guy is, like, ready to give up, and Harry told him to get down on the deck, but he doesn't. No, he's like, oh, no, what? And he gets shot, okay? So he drops him off, and then the guy's been shot, and then Harry is like, oh, gee, I gotta lay low for a while, and then they come to Harry again, and Harry... goes to Marie and says, I know you want to get back to the United States, and so I bought you a plane ticket that's leaving tomorrow, and, you know, have a good life. And it's like, yeah, he really likes her. He really does. But she just said that she was trying to get back home, and he thinks he's doing her this huge favor by buying her the plane ticket. And lo and behold, he comes back, and she skipped the plane because she wants to be there with him. Okay.
Yeah, she's like, yeah, that's cute, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, I can make my own decisions. I don't need you to buy me a plane ticket.
Yeah. So meanwhile, the authorities are after Harry because they suspect it was his boat, but they're not 100% sure. And they're thinking also that Harry's this American and he doesn't want to get involved in politics anyway. And if he knows anything, maybe Harry will turn over the resistance guys to him. And to get leverage on Harry, they pick up his buddy Eddie, played by Walter Brennan. Oh, the incomparable character actor, Walter Brennan. They pick up Eddie, who is a drunk, and they're trying to...
A rummy, yes.
And they're trying to get information out of him, and they're trying to put pressure on Harry, and Harry's not telling them anything. But then, meanwhile, the resistance guys come back to Harry and say, oh, you know, that guy, he got shot, and he's not doing so well, and nobody knows here knows how to, you know, take a bullet out. We can't get a doctor because they're watching all the doctors, and we've got him here in the cellar of this hotel where you're staying, and can you come, please, you know, help us with it? And so Harry goes and he takes the bullet out of the guy. He does a little surgery on him. And meanwhile, the wife starts coming on to him, the wife of the resistance guy. And it's like, yeah, he's got, you know, two women who want him, doesn't know what to do. Tough life Harry's got here. And then finally, after they picked up Harry, well, we won't give away the whole ending, but it kind of comes down to this confrontation between Harry and the bad guys, the local authorities, and how are they going to get out of it? How are they going to get off the island? How are they going to help the resistance people? La-da-da-da-da. That's kind of
okay, but spoiler, the women actually end up saying, screw you, Harry, and they end up together.
No,
there was a lot of chemistry. She was...
No.
Between the two.
No.
Yeah.
No. This is 1944. We don't have any of that kind of stuff going on there. Okay?
Yeah, but a plot twist.
Yeah, but Harry does end up sticking with Slim. She's his kind of guy.
I mean, come on.
Not the wife of
No, not even a chance.
No.
I mean, they tried, and then we learned that there actually was a chance that the wife was going to end up with Bogey. But
yeah,
they did some...
Apparently there was an earlier version of the script.
They shopped it, and the audience liked... It's like, you can't break up Slim and Steve.
Yeah. Well, I think... Yeah, and so, it sounds to me like they wrote the first script, and they're thinking, well, we'll have these two women kind of vying for Harry, and they just didn't anticipate what things were going to be like between Harry and Slim, between Bogart and Bacall. And once people saw that, it's like, there is no way that he ends up with anybody but Bacall. Can't even buy it, not even to come close. So, and actually there's this stray line late in the movie where they come to Harry. I think it's when the wife comes up to Harry's room, and they have this little scene where she gives him this jewelry, and she says, "Oh, sell this to raise some money for the cause or whatever." And originally, I think this was going to be kind of like the scene in Casablanca where Ingrid Bergman is waiting in the office for him and whatever. But it ends up being this really short thing, and there's this line where the people say that, you know, she's up in the room, and Harry actually says, oh, that's all over. Which indicates that maybe that was a holdover from earlier in the script, an earlier version of the script, where they actually do have a little bit more going on. But by the time we get to the final cut, there's nothing there. Nothing there. It's all Slim and Harry. So that's the background. Backdrop. Not the background. It's the backdrop. That's the story. That's the plot. That's the scenario.
One more description?
That's the storyline. That's the, that's the foundation. That's what we've got. Okay.
What else do we have?
All right, so let's talk about, we mentioned that there's a fantastic cast in this movie. This isn't just, these aren't just, you know, your B-list. These aren't just your... you know, round up the usual suspects. These are some high-quality people that we've got in here. We'll talk more about Bogart later. We mentioned Walter Brennan. Eddie? Oh, my gosh. Eddie, I guess Eddie holds some kind of a record because he got nominated for Best Character Actor and won it, like, three times in a row. And Eddie is...
Walter?
Yeah.
You keep on calling him Eddie.
Well, Eddie's the character's name.
Yeah, but
Walter
Brennan
is
the actor.
Yeah, Walter Brennan. Okay. So you're going to see Walter Brennan in like 100 things. He did movies, he did television, he did westerns, he did crime dramas, he did comedies, he did everything. And he could play just about any character that you wanted him to play, but he was at his best playing these kind of goofy sidekick sorts of guys. He does it in the westerns, he does it, he's in a couple of these westerns that Howard Hawks does, like Rio Bravo, and he's just lovable. One of the things I learned about Walter Brennan, he's got this great voice, this high-pitched kind of, oh, Harry, everybody. Okay, he was actually in World War I, and he got gassed.
Oh.
And his vocal cords got damaged because of poison gas. So that's
wow. The reason he talked like this.
But anyway, that became kind of his signature, and he's just perfect as Eddie.
Oh, yeah.
The lovable...
Oh, yeah, he's lovable and frustrating and...
Yeah, the lovable rummy, he's not really dependable, but you just want to have him around all the time. And he's got the great line about, was you ever bit by a dead bee? And, again, that's beautiful dialogue written. That comes around a couple of times in this movie. He steals away on the boat. Bogart, Harry doesn't want him to go with him on the run to get the resistance guys, and he actually, you know, slaps him and insults him and hurts his feelings just so he won't come on the boat with him. But then he ends up stowing away anyway, and then he figures out that, oh, you were just trying to protect me. And it's there's this wonderful bromance between the two of them. Harry's taken care of Eddie, and Eddie thinks he's taken care of Harry. So anyway.
And Eddie's a little jealous of Marie.
A little bit, although
she wins him over.
She wins him over because she's the only one who will actually listen to him and talk to him and take him seriously. And oh yeah,
yeah. He kind of assumes that everybody else is not like Carrie and that they'll just ignore him.
Yeah. So, okay, we got him. We already mentioned Dolores Moran, who did not have a long career, but I think she's actually really good in this movie. The little
she is,
bit that
yeah.
she does, the way she, yeah, she. She kind of comes on to Harry. It's like she's faithful to her husband, but it's sort of like, I've never been in the room with a real man before. You just get this whole vibe from her, and it's just because Harry doesn't take any crap from her and puts in her place, and like, oh, gee, nobody's ever treated me this way before. But no, she's quite good in it. We've got Hoagy Carmichael. We got to have a piano player. Okay, there's so much of this movie that's reminiscent of Casablanca, which had come out just 3 years earlier, and part of it is...
I think it was just like a year or two before.
Well, yeah, I guess 42 and 44, yeah. part of it is you got to have a piano player in the bar who's kind of the confidant of the main characters, and in this case, it's Hoagy Carmichael, who we have talked about before on this show.
From the best years of our lives.
Yeah, where he plays, interestingly enough, a piano player in a bar, right? Yeah. And this works out well because he actually is a piano player and a songwriter.
And he's a friend of Howard Hawks. And Lauren Bacall, while she was waiting to get signed for a movie, well, she was already signed personally by Howard Hawks, which he had, like, never done before, to uh-huh. personally sign somebody.
Okay.
And... he would have parties at his house, and she met Hoagy Carmichael there. So she already knew him.
I didn't know this.
Yeah, and, yeah, so she would go to his house, and Howard Hawks' wife, as many people who have already watched this movie and researched it, that's where Slim comes from, is Howard would call his wife Slim.
Okay.
And, I guess she was really beautiful, and Bacall couldn't understand why Howard Hawks was, like, spending time with her and all these other... if he was really happy in his marriage, because it's mm-hmm. like, she's gorgeous. She hadn't experienced much
relationship-wise,
so
yeah.
she...
Uh-huh.
She got to meet a lot of people at Howard Hawks' house.
No, I didn't know she knew Hoagy Carmichael. Yeah.
Yes, she did. She already knew him before that. Oh. And she also knew about Bogey. She watched... Casablanca in the theater and was like, he's no Leslie Howard. Which I think it's so funny that she was attracted to Leslie Howard.
Yeah, well, Leslie Howard...
he's just a pretty boy.
Yeah, like, Gone with the Wind.
Yeah.
And actually, Leslie Howard and Humphrey Bogart were friends because they had been in the Petrified Forest together, which was Humphrey Bogart's first decent role, where he plays a gangster there. Betty Davis is in that movie, too. And I guess Leslie Howard personally insisted that Bogart get the role of the gangster in that movie because they didn't want to cast him initially. And it ended up being, you know, the thing that actually became a stepping stone for him. So they both like Leslie Howard, although for different reasons.
Well, we don't know.
You're gonna see Sheldon Leonard in this movie, and Sheldon Leonard. We've also seen Sheldon Leonard before in our holiday specials, right? What, you're giving me a puzzled look, Sheldon Leonard?
I don't recognize him.
From
the name.
It's a Wonderful Life, Nick the bartender.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, Nick. Sorry, Martini. Not Martini, but Nick. Yes.
Yeah, you
yes.
were thinking of Martini. Yeah, Nick. And Sheldon Leonard always played gangsters. I mean, that's the only thing he could play. And he had a pretty thick New York accent. And so all he could play is, like, New York gangsters. And in this movie, he's only got about 3 or 4 lines in this movie. And he tries. He tries his darndest to come across as having a French accent. But it doesn't even begin to work. But he looks great. He looks menacing. And you want to see him get beat up, which he does. And anyway, but he's really good. And he goes on to become a famous producer and, like, did the Dick Van Dyke Show and a bunch of other really successful TV shows. Anyway, so you're going to see him in here. The guy that plays Frenchie, who owns the bar, hotel, restaurant, all this stuff, was a guy named Marcel Dalio, who was also in Casablanca, playing a very, very similar role. He's also playing a French guy who works at the bar at Rick's place. And I didn't realize until I researched this, but he literally was a refugee from France who had to flee when the Nazis invaded and just barely got out.
Wow.
He and his wife, actually is in Casablanca. She's Yvonne. The woman at the beginning who's got the thing for Rick that
anyway, she looks a little bit like Dolores. Like,
yeah, she does. Yeah, she does. Okay, then we're also going to see a really good performance from Dan Seymour, who plays Renard. He is the guy who's kind of on loan from the Gestapo, working with the local authorities. So he is the main bad guy. And you'll probably recognize him because he's just got really dark hair and dark eyes, and he's really, really heavy set. And he almost always plays bad guys. In fact, he was even a villain in the Batman TV show. I forget what character he played there, but he's quite good. I mean, you just hate his guts. I mean, immediately he just walks in, and within 2 seconds, you know he's the baddest bad guy that there is, and you want him to get his comeuppance, which of course he does. And then the guy who plays Johnson, the client of Harry's at the beginning, who owes him all the money but can't pay him off before he gets himself killed. Oh, by the way, he was going to skip the country without paying him at all. It's only because he and Slim together cornered him to get him to pay up. That's played by Walter Sandy, who's another really familiar face that did dozens and dozens of things. So anyway, you've got this great cast, you've got great writing, you got a great director, and that's what's going to make this such a classic.
Okay, so then why should people who don't normally watch old movies watch this? What should people who have watched this 100 times maybe look at it? How should they?
Maybe we should start by talking a little bit about Lauren Bacall and how her. She's playing this young American. Lauren Bacall is how old when she does this movie?
19.
Okay. She's only 19
years old. She's never done a movie
before.
She had a couple of roles on the stage that didn't last long, but she just has her on the weekends work from the New York Theater, and she also did the American Academy of Dramatic Arts for a year, and she just had to keep on stomping on the pavement to try to get jobs. She was very insecure and shy, but she would force herself to go up to producers and ask, demand to read. And she just never gave up. She had to do a bunch of different odds and end jobs. So she had to be an usher in the theater, and she was a hostess, and she had to, a model wearing clothes for clients to see if they wanted to buy it for their wives or if the wives wanted to buy it, buy their clothes.
Yeah, when they would have models in department stores.
But she was flat-chested, so she got fired from her first job.
Mm-hmm.
And
go grow a pair, they said.
Basically.
Yeah.
And she actually had somebody who had a crush on her that was an editor at Harper's Bazaar that knew, like, the...
That's where they did the photo shoot of, right?
Yes, the design editor for Harper's Bazaar, and she had her picture taken, and...
Bada-bing, bada-boom.
Bada-bing, bada-boom.
Howard Hawks sees it and says, I want her in...
Well, supposedly his wife saw her, and she convinced him to sign her, but...
Okay.
Either way, he obviously became a fan of hers.
But, yeah, I mean, you think about, and again, I didn't
know
most of
this. But, yeah, she looks worldly. She looks like she's had experience in the bedroom or in relationships romantically.
Yeah, I mean,
she looks like she knows.
She's been around the block. That's what, and she's playing this character who's supposed to be.
Great voice. I mean, whose voice is better in that era?
Oh, nobody.
Nobody.
Nobody's got Lauren McCall's voice.
She's 19.
19 years old.
She sounds like she smoked 20 packs a day.
Yeah. She's 19, and it looks like you could pick her up and throw her like a javelin through the window because she's so slight.
But she also is so assertive.
Yes. And she's playing this character, this almost unbelievable character, the way it's written. 22 years old, American, and somehow
she's
she ends
traveling
up
on her own, independent, and
on the
she's
island
had some
of Martinique.
Abuse at home because she gets hit, and
she's been slapped around. You can tell that, and we don't know anything. She's this mystery woman, and when she's out of money, I can just pick up some guy, get him to pay for my drinks, and all that kind of stuff. And that's the character she's playing. And to realize that she is this nervous, really kind
of
sheltered.
Yeah, so one of the first, like, oh my goodness, steamy scenes is when she just, their first, like, introduction face-to-face where there's actually dialogue exchange, where she asks, does anybody have a match or whatever. I guess she was nervous. She was shaking so bad, like, her hand was shaking with the cigarette. And so she had to look down. Put her chin down and look up, and then that's what became her iconic the look. And she also talks about how Bogey would joke. This is before they even had any type of feelings about each other.
You know,
he would
even
put her at ease, and
we haven't even mentioned the fact that they become a couple. They meet on the set of this movie, and even though he's in this really tumultuous marriage, where the two of them are beating each other up on a regular basis, and his wife is really a heavy drinker and quite paranoid, and all that stabbed him once with a knife.
Yes,
Would throw whatever object was handy across the room at him. I mean, just really a violent relationship. And he meets this sweet teenage girl, and actually, Bogey has a reputation for never fooling around with any of the women. He's a very serious actor, very professional, all that sort of thing, but he meets this sweet girl, and it starts out as he's kind of her mentor, and then eventually it's just like, oh man,
there's no going back there, no denying.
I was just going to say, the thing to keep in mind, when you watch this movie, and it's really only about, I don't know, 5-10 minutes in when we see Lauren Bacall for the first time. I can never see it quite the same way now that I know that backstory about how incredibly nervous she was to do that scene. But you see her, and this is the first time any American moviegoer has ever seen Lauren Bacall. She's standing there leaning against the door frame, asking for a match, and my God, she just looks so incredibly confident, and she's got that low voice, and she delivers those iconic lines.
Yeah, I'm beside myself.
Yeah. I mean, and this is why you watch the movie. Okay?
Yeah. That's only my only complaint is I want more of her. I want more of Slim and Steve, too.
Oh, yeah.
Because their moments together are so impactful and the dialogue is so good, but it's also how well both of them deliver their dialogue.
Yeah.
To where you just can't get enough.
Yeah.
What? Like, no, could we have more of that, please? I mean, all of this other stuff is important and good and great and, oops, sorry about that noise. Don't know what that was.
Yeah.
I guess I wasn't saying anything important, but you want more of it. You want more of and I haven't really had that in a movie before where it's like, listen, this other stuff is really great. It really is. But I need more of Bogey and Bacall.
Yeah. Well,
I don't know I've never had that before.
That's why after you see this movie, then you go watch The Big Sleep. And then you watch Key Largo. Yes. And then you watch Dark Passage.
That I guess not as many people really remember to
watch.
But
no, this is... okay, can we talk about Bogey now?
We're done with Bacall? Yeah.
We've talked about... Okay, if you've got more, we can come back to Bacall. We've talked about your crush. Let's talk about my crush, which is Humphrey Bogart. I mean, there's a reason that this guy was the number one star in Hollywood right about this time. He's just... And this is a guy who has knocked around quite a bit. The thing about Bogart that is so cool is that nobody even thought he could be a leading man. This is a guy who wants to act. He's on the stage at a fairly young age in New York, and then he starts getting cast in these roles as gangsters. And he's not a super attractive guy. He's not very tall. He's kind of scrawny. He's got this thing with his lip that nobody knows for sure exactly what happened to it, but he's got this big scar, and his lower lip doesn't quite move, and it gives him a little bit of a lisp when he talks. He's not imposing at all, but he's got this incredible confidence. You look at Bogart, and he's just so sure of himself. And he's got that great voice, which you can only get by destroying your vocal cords with 2 packs of cigarettes a day. And he's so sure of himself. And in this character, very much like Rick in Casablanca, very much like Philip Marlowe in Sam Spade in the Private Eye movies that he had made also, is this guy, he knows himself. He can read everybody in the room. He knows exactly what he wants to do, what he wants to get out of life. He knows what his values are. He claims to be apolitical. He's not getting involved in any of this kind of stuff, but he sees the bad guys, and the bad guys are just so freaking bad, and it's so obvious. He just has to step in and do the right thing. He treats people with respect. We should talk also about this movie from a political standpoint. This is a war movie. It's going on while the war is raging. This has come out a couple years after Casablanca. And Casablanca was a movie that was made very much... It was supposed to be a propaganda film. The only reason they really wanted to make the movie was to try to get Americans to go along with the war effort and get involved in the war that was going on in Europe. And a lot of Americans didn't want to. And just like Richard Blaine, Humphrey Bogart's character, he doesn't want to get involved, but he finally realizes, God, these Nazis are so bad, I'm going to have to step up and do the right thing and get involved. Okay, 1944, when Key Largo comes along, America's...
To Have and Have Not.
I'm sorry, To Have and Have Not, America's already in the war, so we don't really need to be persuaded, but we do need kind of a reminder that we're doing the right thing and these fascists are really terrible, and it's the same sort of thing. You got an American who says, I don't want to get involved in your political stuff, but, geez, these Nazis, they're so awful.
That's never going to happen again.
Yeah. Well, and that's part of the message, too, is one of the things that I... Can I go on? Can I talk about my history lesson here?
I think this is an appropriate time. Yeah, it's an appropriate time. Go off, Chet.
When I watched these movies as kids, I loved watching war movies, especially World War II movies when I was a kid. But when you watch war movies, the only thing you learn about the war are the bombs and the tanks and the bullets and the battles. And you assume that everybody knows who the good guys are and who the bad guys are. And obviously the Germans and the Nazis, you know, they're the bad guys. And all the Allies are the good guys. And you assume that everybody in all of these countries is united in their opposition to the Nazis. Everybody recognizes them as evil. Everybody wants to stand up against them. Everybody wants to fight them until the bitter end, and they're willing to sacrifice everything to do it. That's what you see in the typical war movie, but that's not real life. It never has been. It never will be. When the Nazis invade France, the French want to be independent, obviously, and they're mortified when their country falls so quickly to the Nazis, but it's not like every single person in France hates everything that the Nazis stand for. And the Nazis don't want to destroy the whole country. The way that you win wars is that you take power and then you find people within the country who are willing to support your causes and you put them in charge, which is what they do, which is what Vichy is. Technically, Vichy is supposed to be independent. It's unoccupied France, but the only reason that they're allowed to be there is because they're willing to go along with what the Germans are doing. And there are lots of people in the French government and in the French population who are willing to do this. There are lots of people all over Europe who are complicit with the anti-Semitism of the Nazis. They might not have liked the Holocaust, but they didn't like the Jews. There are lots of people all over Europe who didn't really think that democracy could work, and they were okay with fascists and authoritarians and all that kind of stuff. And that's part of the reason that the Germans were able to succeed. And when you watch movies like this, like when I first saw these movies, Casablanca and To Have and Have Not, I'm like, what's going on here? Why don't the Nazis just kill everybody that they want to kill? And who are these people with Vichy? And what are they, French or are they German? I thought all the French hated the Germans. All the French hated the Nazis. No, that's not the way it is. And it really requires good people in the moment to recognize what's going on and to stand up for their beliefs. Because it's really tempting to go along with the strong men, the men who have the power, the men who seem to be getting everything done because they're taking control of everything. And it takes a courageous and morally upright person to say, wait a second, what these guys are all about? This isn't cool. And the only way that we're going to stop these people is if brave people get together and stand up against them. And that's the message of Casablanca, and behind all the romance, that's the message of To Have and Have Not. And I think that's one of the things you need to keep in mind when you watch this movie.
Well, you also need to keep in mind that, again, Bacall is Jewish. Yeah. Howard Hawks, the director, doesn't know this.
Yeah.
But also, I'm not sure, even though she's aware of anti-Semitism, she's young, and she admits to not really knowing much about the war efforts. Like, she would dance with
soldiers
and stuff, but she admitted to where she's not really grasping what's happening. So I'm sure she's not even grasping entirely that she's helping make a movie to fight anti-Semitism, even though Howard Hawks doesn't realize he's really doing that either.
Because not everybody in America is really following and understanding the ramifications of what's happening in Europe. In fact, there are hundreds of thousands of Americans before, you know, the attack on Pearl Harbor who are complicit, who are rooting on the Nazis. They think they've got the right ideas about things. Again, maybe they didn't understand exactly everything that was happening with the Holocaust, but the basic ideas that the Nazis said that they stood for, there were lots of people in America who were just fine with that. So if you're a kid growing up in the 1940s, it's just not obvious to you that the Nazis are terrible. You don't fully understand how bad anti-Semitism can be and how ugly it can get. And all you know, if you're Lauren Bacall, is I better not tell people that I'm Jewish because they might not like me as
well. Well, one time she went on holiday with her mom to Florida, and they were staying in a hotel that was a little expensive, and so they were going to change to a different hotel, and the guy asked, what's your religion? And they said Jewish, and he didn't let them stay there, so they had to keep on staying in the more expensive. She was actually really nervous to tell Bogey that she was Jewish. She didn't know why, because she ends up asking him. She's like, is that a problem for you? And he's like, I don't care it's your like, religion. I just care about that. Who yeah. you are and what mm-hmm. you believe in. Like, I don't care about your religious beliefs. And she's yeah. like, yeah, why did I even ask? I knew that, but... I mean, so she knows that it can be a thing.
That's one aspect of these characters that Bogey plays that is close to his personality. He grew up in a home. His mom was a suffragette. She was actually a famous illustrator, made tons of money. His dad was a surgeon. A lot of people assume that Humphrey Bogart had this really, you know, rough and tumble upbringing and all that. No, he came from this incredibly wealthy family. They sent him off to boarding schools. And when he first goes to Broadway, they keep casting him in these roles as these kind of, effeminate, spoiled rich kids. And it's only because Bogey joins the Navy, he ends up being kind of a rebel in his boarding schools, and he drops out of school and he joins the Navy, and he starts saying, hey, you know, these guys are genuine, they're real. And from that point on, he's this, like, I hate phonies, I don't want to be around people who pretend to be something that they're not. And at the same time, yeah, he came from this liberal family, and he had their same political views. And that's something else that you see. In this movie, you are actually going to see some people of color. Now, it's 1944.
Yeah, so you still have to have the bartender that's like, yes, sir?
Yeah.
It's a little racist.
Well, yeah. I mean, you got to keep it in context. I mean, in the 1940s, black characters in stories and black actors in the movies are treated horribly. Okay? It's not anywhere even close. I mean, the only good thing that seems to have happened is in 1939, they gave an Academy Award to, what was her name? Hattie McDonald.
From Gone with the Wind?
Yeah, from Gone with the Wind. But Gone with the Wind is actually, you know, a terribly racist movie. But they did at least give an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress to somebody from that movie. But generally speaking, no, they're not going to be sympathetic. They're not going to write black characters or Latino characters or Native characters or whatever as, you know, full human beings. But at least in this movie... Again, because part of the message is fascism is bad, authoritarianism is bad, anti-Semitism is bad. Part of what you see are characters of color who are being treated, even though they don't have major roles in the film, they're at least being treated with respect and dignity by some of the characters like Harry and like Frenchie, who owns the bar. And so we see them as dancers and musicians and servers and all that sort of thing. And there is a very subtle message, and again, it's kind of weak tea, but there at least is a message that says the world we want to live in is a world where these people are not persecuted, they're at least treated as regular citizens, which for 1944, that's about as good as you're going to get in terms of inclusion in a Hollywood movie. So that's part of what's going on here.
What's your favorite scene?
Oh, my God. Well, the obvious answer would be those first couple of scenes between Bogey and Bacall. But I think for me, like I said, you want to see yourself as Bogart, okay? If you're a man, and particularly if you're a man and you know you're not the most handsome man, you're not the most physically imposing man. You look at a guy like Bogart and you say, well, you know, he doesn't have, you know, he's no Burt Lancaster, okay? He isn't just incredibly chiseled, handsome, you know, Greek god kind of a figure. But yet, he's got this aura about him, okay? And you say, well, you know, I'm not all that handsome either, but maybe if I play my cards right and if I just play up my confidence enough, I could be like him. That's part of why you love Bogart so much, okay? So for me, the scene that I love the most, the two scenes, are after he has picked up the wife of the resistance leader and he's doing the surgery and the wife is starting to kind of come on to him a little bit and Slim starts to get jealous. And like the scene where the wife is trying to help with the surgery and then she passes out on the floor and she was supposed to be holding the chloroform to use it on her husband in case he woke up, and it ends up spilling on the floor. And then Bogart says, you know, fan those, you know, that those fumes away or we're all going to be out. And then Bacall takes the fan, and she's waving the chloroform towards the wife on the floor. And then later, Bogart carries the wife out and puts her on the cot, and he's kind of looking at her like, what should I do now? And then Slim comes down the stairs and sees them together. And oh, anyway, all those scenes where Slim is giving Bogart a bad time because you can tell she's jealous, but at the same time she's trying to make fun of the wife so that she's sure that Harry sees that the wife really isn't the right woman for him. That's, I mean, to see the guy that you aspire to be having two women fight over him, it doesn't get any better than that.
I don't know if that's healthy.
Oh, it's incredibly healthy.
It's not healthy for the women involved.
Well, you know, if the woman is, you know, up to Slim standards, then she doesn't have anything to worry about. Yeah.
Even though, again, we realize she does have something to worry about because they had an alternative.
Yeah, well, it is true that, Bogart really is, you know, actually. But again, in real life, he's got this terrible marriage. And then when he and Bogart, Bacall, finally end up together, they end up staying married until Bogart dies. And, of course, because he smokes two packs a day and drinks probably a bottle of scotch every day, he only lives to be 57 years old. So.
Well, were you surprised to learn that he's not exactly like the characters he portrays?
Yeah, I really was. I mean, especially when I first
learned... Because in her autobiography, she shares some of his letters, and they're kind of like...
kind of cheesy.
Milquetoast.
Kind of cheesy and very sweet.
Yes, yeah.
And
he's very needy, too.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things that I learned about Bogart is he wished he could be a writer. I mean, he thought maybe I could be a screenwriter or something like that, and he wasn't a good writer. But he admired good writers, and he read all the time. And even though he dropped out of school, he read constantly, and he really educated himself on it. He was somewhat of an intellectual, even though he didn't even finish high school, as far as I understand. But yeah, he was in their relationship. Like I said, he wasn't, even though he had been married three times before he even meets Bacall. He's actually pretty staid and pretty, like I said, kind of professional, and he doesn't have a reputation for messing around with the women that he's in movies with. But Bacall is just different. Bacall just like, oh my gosh, this woman is, she's what I've been waiting for my whole life. And
well, and I think when you know that they're having this relationship grow while they're shooting it, and when she sings, like, is this what I waited for, you know? Mm-hmm. You're just like, oh my gosh, that's so cute.
Yeah, I think this is the only movie where Lauren
where she sings. Yeah, and
yeah.
They were gonna have a man actually dub over her voice.
Oh really?
But
I didn't know that.
Howard Hawks. I don't remember the name of who was gonna sing, but it was gonna be tenor, and her voice is low enough to where he could sound like her. But they liked her.
I don't know.
Cool is that? It's her first movie. She sings. She dances. She does some comedy. She does some sexy. She's the whole package. Natural beauty.
Mm-hmm.
Hardly has any makeup on. Hardly has her hair done.
Yeah.
Whew.
She's incredible.
To me, she's a smoke show.
Mm-hmm.
And what I think is really cool is I had been sleeping on Lauren Bacall, so that means, like, to where, you know, I she's always been there, something I could actually look up to, but I didn't. And then all of a sudden it hits me. It's like, oh, my gosh. I have Barbra Streisand, and Bacall's also been there this whole time for another person to look up to.
Mm-hmm.
And
she's maybe a little easier to relate to when you find out that she comes from this rather conservative background, and she's
well,
so
and
shy
it was kind of like she had to be in the right place at the right time. So, I mean, Chad and I both kind of had this where it's like, oh, yeah, we'd like to be an actor for once a week,
One day a month.
One day a month.
I would like to be a celebrity. I'd like to be famous one day a month.
Yes, but we both had, like, this wanting to be an act. I actually wanted to do Broadway after I saw Barbra, and I did not care that I was not a triple threat. And if I actually would have read Bacall's book, I maybe would have understood more where it's like, oh, you know, it might not be in my cards. she ended up living in New York. If she wouldn't have grew up in New York and didn't have family to stay with, I'm not sure she would have made it, because you have to pay rent, right? But she had, her mom was really extremely supportive of her daughter in any career endeavor she wanted to do. So she had a place to stay while she was taking some acting lessons. Mm-hmm. And so it was kind of like she was this idealist dreamer, really head in the sky and loving movies. And so, like, I actually relate to her a lot more than with Barbara and being insecure. And
yeah. And Bogart also is somewhat, it's weird, because even though he's got this really wealthy family, they don't want him to be an actor. And this is really rebellion on his part. He joins the Navy and he says, now I want to be an actor. And he does kind of cash in on some family connections to actually get his first few parts. Because my impression is that he was not a very good actor when he started. And I don't think he's all that impressive in his earlier movies. But he gets in and he just works his butt off. And he'll take any part that they'll give him, even if he thinks they're terrible parts. And he just keeps going and going, and he gets better and better, and eventually the big break comes his way.
Well, yeah, she sought counsel with a lot of people so she would try to get attention from producers and stuff, but she would just, like, barge into, like, when she was an usher, she was like, well, this is going to be a temporary job, so I'm okay with losing my job if I go and barge into an actor's room. And so she did it to Danny Kaye, she did it to Vincent Price. When she was younger, her family had a friend that knew Bette Davis, and so she actually got to meet Bette Davis, and she would ask, well, she was too shy to actually end up asking anything. But, I mean, she actually sought advice, and she was young, so even though maybe she wasn't worldly and didn't understand everything, she actually, I mean, it's really a testament to her that she worked really hard to get where she was. Yeah. It wasn't just her beauty got her where she was, right, which is what I thought it was. And I was like, yeah, she's confident. Which is actually something also we both kind of see ourselves to, where we're not just, we don't stand out in a crowd.
Right.
So we both relate to the characters that we're looking to for who we would like to be. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to be just this commanding presence in a room, have this sultry, husky voice.
And I think there's something cool, too, about the roles that they chose. Once they finally got into a situation where they had some autonomy and could say what kind of roles they wanted to play, and Bogey actually started his own production company briefly later in his career. But you can tell when he's doing these characters, this is the kind of guy that he wants. He puts everything into these characters. He's at his best in these characters because this is the kind of person that he wants to hold up as being an ideal. These men who are fiercely independent, they lack all pretense, they're brutally honest with people, but at the same time they are not exactly sensitive, but they are empathetic, they have values, and they want to be on the right side of history, ultimately. He's like that, and I mean, his four best movies, you know, Casablanca, this movie, and The Big Sleep, and The Maltese Falcon, and that's what you get in all of these movies. It's this, he's kind of like Cyrano de Bergerac, without the nose and without the poetry. He's this independent guy who knows who he is. He stands for the right things, and he's not going to suck up to anybody. And in the end, his virtue is going to win the day. And that says something about, I think, the kind of man that Humphrey Bogart wanted to be, even if maybe he wasn't so grand and glorious in his personal life. He at least recognized this is what a heroic figure is. And he really portrayed those characters. And I think, even though he's great in the Caine Mutiny later in his career, where he plays the paranoid ship captain. But really, these four roles are so beautiful, and it's all the little things that he does. He's at his best when he's understated, when he's stoic. And I just love seeing Humphrey Bogart do these little bits of business where, like when he's working on the tackle in his room, just working there with the screwdriver on the rod and the reel. And there's this one scene in Casablanca the flashback when they're in Paris and when they're in the restaurant and they go to the window because the Germans are starting to their invasion and they hear the bombs. When Bogart goes to the window and turns the latch and opens the window, it's this little thing he does in a tenth of a second. I could watch him do that a million times. He just looks so incredibly smooth, so confident. You just see this person who is totally self-aware, totally in the moment, and you believe everything about what he's doing. And you see that in this movie also. You see it in the two Private Detective movies, and that's what you look at and you say, I want to be that guy. If only I could be that guy. If only for 5 minutes I could walk around with that kind of confidence and that kind of poise and that kind of self-assuredness. Oh my gosh, I'd be the king of the world.
Yeah, and if you see Chet in person, he's actually really just, he curls up. He has no confidence.
I'm a doofus.
Yeah.
I'm a doofus in person. But no.
You have confidence.
No, oh, there are so many times that I just say, God, and actually, okay. Every once in a while, when I'm at work and nobody is watching, I'll say, you know, for the next 30 seconds, I'm going to do my job the way Humphrey Bogart would have done it in one of these movies. I'm just going to try to be so cool. And it takes so much energy to try to be that, you know, calm and confident, you know, that I can't keep it up for very long. But it's, yeah, that's
what I want to be. Well, and I want to be more like, I could watch her do her little hip swing a million times.
Oh, the little move, the little dance move she does at the end of this movie when they're walking out of the bar. Oh, my God. That's just so
And she has such perfect. A serious face, and you learn also that she actually liked to make people laugh because it helped her make her feel comfortable. And I've been trying to do some portraits, and I have a very serious face, and it's like it doesn't look like me because usually when you see me, I'm usually smiling or I have some type of smirk on my face.
Yeah.
But...
Yeah, you gotta work. I gotta work
on the serious face, and I gotta work on lowering my voice. So I need to go to the mountains, I guess, and read aloud.
Read really loud.
So Howard Hawks is like, listen, you got a low voice. I want you to be able to keep that low voice even when things get scary or when normally a woman's voice fluctuates.
Yeah.
You're gonna keep it low.
Yeah, what was he said? Oh, there's nothing worse. You never want to hear a woman screech or whatever. That's the worst thing. So you keep that voice low. The louder you get, the lower you get. So, and she really had to train to do that. And, it, of course, it comes across. You see her in the movies. It's like, oh, wow, what a great voice. I wish I had that voice. Well,
she worked on it.
She worked hard to get that voice. Yeah. That just happened.
Bogey worked hard
to get his voice too. All those cigarettes, all those years. Oh my God! You know, it doesn't come easy.
Well, what else?
I don't know. There's not much else to say about this. You know, someday we'll have to. I don't know if we can even ever talk about Casablanca. Maybe that's such a big fish. You know, who can land that one? But sometime maybe we'll talk about.
Oh, the fish! Oh, I like the tie-in.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you mean to do that?
No, I just that was Freudian, yeah. But yeah, watch this movie. If you've never seen a Humphrey Bogart movie, if you've never seen a Lauren Bacall movie, start with this one, okay?
Yes.
I think you're going to get hooked, and I think then you're going to start watching every other movie that you can find that these people are in, and you're almost never going to be disappointed. But
and you're
going
to learn to never give up, never settle, never surrender.
Be true to yourself. Be confident, and you stand up to the bad guys when the pressure is on.
And love conquers all.
All right.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Till next time. Bye.
Bye.